Welcome to this week's edition of Flashback Friday. It's your opportunity to get some good review by listening to episodes from the past that Kevin has handpicked to help you along your investment journey. If you'd like to partner with Kevin and join his team at Sunrise Capital Investors, head to investwithsunrise.com to learn more. That's investwithsunrise.com. Enjoy the show.
You've been searching for the best way to generate passive income in your life and heard that real estate is a great way to do it. But you're tired of all the so-called gurus who are all talk and no substance. Get ready to celebrate because Kevin Bupp has spent 14 years successfully making it happen. This is the Real Estate Investing for Cash Flow podcast. Now, here's Kevin Bupp.
Hey guys, Kevin Bupp here, and I want to welcome you to another episode of the Real Estate Investing for Cash Flow podcast. Our mission is to help you build and maintain massive amounts of cash flow through income-producing real estate investments. Now, our guest for this week's show is real estate and short-term rental expert, Stephen Potosky. Now, Stephen is the founder of the Lexus Group, which is a multifaceted real estate firm that has verticals in luxury vacation rentals, luxury vacation developments, and a restoration arm that turns ancient ruins into luxury private estates. And so with that, guys, it's an honor to welcome Stephen Potosky to the show. Stephen, how are you doing today?
I'm great, my man. Thank you for having me on the show. I'm really excited.
Yeah, excited to have you here. Excited to peel back the curtain and get a better understanding of not just you as an individual, but your company and the multiple verticals underneath it. And so why don't we start on the personal side, Steve, and maybe expand upon you. I'll give you that brief introduction, but there's a lot more to the story, a lot more to the man himself. And so take a few minutes if you would and just give our listeners a little more insights as to who you are and you know what it is you do.
Sure. Thank you. So for me, I'm 42 years old. I have my wife, Carrie, and two kids, Cash and Allegra. So family man at heart. They're the very tip of the pyramid for me. And everything we do is kind of built around that family. So very lucky. My kids are 16. Boy just turned 16 last week, actually. My daughter's 12. So for them, it's interesting. When we connect them to the business, the whole business was started the same week as when my son was born 16 years ago. And we'll kind of get to a connection of the reasons why around that. But for me personally, I grew up in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. So, we're in the Great White North, and it's definitely I think it's a cold place in the winter, which I think is very powerful for entrepreneurship because there's nothing else you can really do. So you just kind of tinker around with entrepreneurial ideas, and it's got a really strong entrepreneurial culture, which is what we love about the city. And went to high school there. I went to school at University of Idaho, stateside, actually. I played on a golf scholarship. So I definitely, back in the day, really enjoyed golf and skiing were kind of the two sports. And chose golf. It was a little lighter on the body and it provided some education and some money around that scholarship. So pursued that. And that was a lot of fun. I was definitely never good enough to make it to the next level, but I was good enough to play have some fun in Div 1 for a while. And that was a remarkable experience and something that I'm encouraging my kids to explore and they're going to pursue in their own. My son's playing golf, my daughter volleyball. So I'm hoping they get a chance to experience that as well. Mm-hmm. And then, 16 years ago, we started the Lexus Group. I was 27 years old, I guess, at the time. So I was relatively young. I had a bit of a career in between working with my family's business, which is around grocery retail. And that was my parents and my sister were involved. It was really fun actual part of it. Even though my parents really grew up in it and built their business. And if I go way back, my parents were, late teenagers when they had me. So it wasn't really a planned event at that time in their life, but they were high school sweethearts and they had, the mission of stay together and be together. But I think I was a bit of a surprise at that time. And I had, fortunately, the front row seat to watch their entrepreneurial journey, basically as teenagers having me enough, obviously, when I become kind of aware of what was going on, I was 7, 8, 9 years old. They started their first business and bought into a grocery store. And I remember sitting there watching. I've shared the story in the past, but I still find it like almost emotional about it. But there's this guy in our kitchen, I should say, and they were signing all these papers and was wondering what my parents were doing. And when they left, I said, "Well, mom and dad, like, what were you doing there?" And they're like, "Oh, we were getting a second mortgage." Like, okay, well, what's a mortgage? And they take the time to explain that. And I said, "What's a second mortgage?" "Well, it's just the first one, but you get two of them." And like, "What are you doing with the money?" I said, "We're buying a business." And so that was a really big leap. That would have been 89. So I was 9 years old. And that was I think the true start of my understanding of entrepreneurship, and then watching the efforts they went through continuously, painfully, up and down for many, many years. And I think that's all I grew up knowing. Same with my sister. Mm-hmm. And kind of naturally both pursued kind of careers in entrepreneurship. And the rest is history, but entrepreneurial journey is very much a journey. And I had lots of ups and downs along the way for me and my wife and our careers. But it's been a fun ride so far, and we're kind of on a neat path right now.
Well, very exciting. Well, I appreciate that. And I'd love to, before we move on to the formation of the Luxus Group, would love to maybe dissect a little bit of your youth, only because, again, just that's all you knew. You made the comment of that, like, that's all you really knew is that entrepreneurial journey. How long, what age were you before you could really process the element of risk that your parents ultimately took on by taking that second mortgage, right? That is a massive leap out of the comfort zone. And so was there a certain age where, like, you really understood and could comprehend the amount of risk that they took on to ultimately provide the life that they did for your family?
You know what? It's a great question. And I think I was either 14 or 15 years old. And I remember that specifically because their first business, when they started to explain, and I started working in the grocery store, I was actually in the meat department. So I had like the smock. That's back when they actually cut meat. Now it's all like processed in a factory, but you know, you bring in a whole side of a cow, and I was working underneath these awesome meat cutters, just real men, you know, knives and blood on their shirts. And it was really a neat experience. So I was always involved in working there from 9 years old, I guess. Probably child labor. I don't think you could do that now, frankly, but back then it was okay. But I was 14 because my parents then bought a second store. And that's when I realized that they had a really, really tough year. The stores opened up too early. And my parents, what I really appreciate, I'm doing the same with my kids, is they let us know as kids, and I was a few years older than my sister, so I was probably a little further ahead on the timeline, but they let us know where they were at financially. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily their net worth, like as an overall, we can guesstimate it, but effectively like what it means to invest into a business, what it means when you lose money or you're in the red, what that's going to mean to our lifestyle and our family. And they just started to share with us what they were making every year, how they were making it. And it really, I think, allowed for a level of entrepreneurial maturity a lot earlier because I felt like I was, you know, somewhat carrying the risk with them, even though I was just a 15-year-old, still blissfully unaware to a certain degree, mm-hmm. but started to realize the magnitude of the decisions they were making and how they made them, why they made them, and how they handled that decision. So that second store really put them under some stress for a couple of years. And then, you know, they stuck through it and they got through it. And all of a sudden, 2-3 years later, 97 specifically, things started to take off again and started to see the benefits of those 36 months of grinding, true grinding, where they got over this really difficult time. And now, you know, they were able to benefit from kind of the runway it created.
Was it, you know, looking back, was you know, some of that like that 36 month span of time where just, you know, they you just were grinding away and just mm-hmm. making it by, you know, putting in the work. I mean, did you notice any change maybe in lifestyle? Was it just all relative, right? At that point, because you don't know any different. You don't know really what else to compare it to. And where I'm going with that is, and I'd love to get a better understanding of how you teach your kids today financial literacy mm-hmm. and just really mm-hmm. get them involved in the business. I've got a 69-year-old, so 6-year-olds, that's a little challenging. Both of my boys yeah. know that we own a business. They know that, you know, that they have a general idea and concept of what it is I do with regards to real estate, and that we buy real estate as an investment. People will rent from mm-hmm. us or buy from us, what have you. But since my oldest being 9, you know, for the past 9 years, things have been pretty good. I did go mm-hmm. through a very challenging time prior to them being born, mm-hmm. and they hear stories mm-hmm. about it. But like, it's hard to associate, like, you know, how bad things were because all they've known is good. And so anyway, I would love yeah. to, you know, I'm always trying to figure out better ways to get them to understand just the element of risk and just really the hard work that me and their mother have put into to build the life that we're able to provide them and to have them not take it for granted. Right. And so just, you know, I would love to hear from you if there's any special tactics or strategies that you utilize to involve your kids. I think that's important. It's an incredibly important part of the journey for sure.
No, I honestly appreciate it so much. I love talking about this, honestly, because obviously schools are built for a certain path. It doesn't teach them necessarily the financial literacy. It certainly doesn't teach them, entrepreneurship. Obviously, more schools are starting to integrate that in, or there's outside programming, but nothing really teaches it like experience in it. And so I had a chance to experience that as a teenager at a time where it was very formative for me and my sister. And as a result, we just were like you said, it was all relative. I did not know anything else, but I was at a point then where I could start to see what my parents, or pardon me, my friends' parents were doing. And they had, you know, the 9-to-5 jobs, and you know, they were on the weekends hanging with their, I go over there and their parents are always there in the weekends and evenings. And I'm like, I don't get it. Like, my parents are working till 6-7 o'clock at night. They work every Saturday for sure. Usually would take Sundays off as kind of a family day, but it's retail grocery. Sunday is the busiest day of the week. Yeah. So they did their best within that. But I never for a moment thought I was like, didn't have enough time with them. They were very incredibly present with the time that we were there. Maybe it was less overall time, but as a result, it's like you said, it's relative. So, but I think the biggest thing when they came back is they communicated to us about what they were doing, why they were doing it, why it was important. And so I never felt like any sort of resentment, like, oh, you're not around. It's more like, oh, you're putting in the hard work. And I think the saying behaviors are caught, not taught, is probably one of the most powerful ones, because their behaviors and the time investment they put in was so profound to me. Obviously, that's how, I mean, you can tell someone to work hard, but when you see someone working hard, it's totally different. Now, how that translated to my kids, just purely out of coincidence, not my desire to have a very difficult time period, but right in almost the same window for them from 2015 through 19, had a really, really tough run. We had a couple of projects that struggled. There were some things that were just really difficult. And my kids got a chance to experience and see that between kind of ages 9 to 12, right in that phase. So they almost had the same experience I did as a child. And so instead of sheltering them away from the stress of it, my wife and I decided to communicate with them about it. Why I'm working long, why it's important to our family that we get through this, what it means. And honestly, I honestly get emotional, but they wrote me like I saved these cards they wrote and different things along the way about the journey. And of course, you know, fortunately we got over it all, but it wasn't without tremendous amount of pain along the way. They're now kind of in that. And I'm so glad, I hate to say I'm glad we had to suffer for a period of time, but I'm so glad they had a chance to experience that from a front row seat, not necessarily themselves. And now they're just hardworking, great kids. And I think so much as a result of us being open with them, not treating them like kids, treating them like young adults and engaging them in what's going on and letting them see the tough stuff. You have to protect them, as all parents need to protect your kids as well. So there's a certain line of communication you might have. But we were pretty open with that line about what it meant to our family. And now when we got over the hump kind of in, you know, 2019, 2020, COVID was a little bit funky as well, but we got over that hump. They felt like they were part of the win as well, which is now they felt a win, a big loss and a win. It's like, that's a huge cycle that to go through over a period of 4 or 5 years. And I think they're all the better for it now. So.
Yeah, no, fantastic. I appreciate you sharing that. I think it's incredibly important. I mean, I love to hear that you share all these aspects of your business and just you guys grow together as a family unit. You know, it's not just you and your wife kind of doing your thing and then the kids being, you know, completely segregated from what his mom and dad does or the struggles and, you know, trials and tribulations you guys go through. So I think that's incredibly important. I appreciate you sharing that with us. I'm sure there's a lot of other folks that are in the same positions as you and I, and they've got younger kids and just really trying to you'll be better involved parents and have them be part of the bigger picture. So anyway, appreciate that, my friend. And now I would love I would love to get a better understanding of the Luxus Group. Tell us, you said you founded it back. What was the year? You'd mentioned a year.
07.
07. Okay. Oh, yeah. Yep. Perfect timing, right? So let's talk about that. Let's talk about, you know, kind of what was the catalyst there? You know, what was the original vision of that company? And then, you know, maybe fast forward to today and tell us a little bit more about what you do.
Sure. Thank you. So the Luxus Group. So Luxus is the Latin word for luxury. And I remember back when we had this concept, which I'll share what it was. We hired this company to do like a name search for us. You know, we paid them $1,000. It was huge. At the time, we had like literally no money. So like pay someone $1,000 to find a business name. And in the initial meeting, they're like, have you heard of Luxus? We're like, no, Luxus. They're like, okay, well, we'll give you that one, but then we're going to go search a whole bunch of other names for you. And they searched for like a month and brought like 50 names to us and went through it. We're like, we like the first one. Is it free or do we still have to pay you for the other ones? And no, at all, they earned the money and we kept with that, trademarked it. And then we started our company and it really was connected to a problem my wife and I were having. I shared the story in the past, but effectively, you know, my son was born Feb 24th, 07. Obviously leading into that, you know, pregnancy is my wife and I love to travel. So she was a career woman as well. She was a news anchor and journalist. She, you know, made her own way, and she was like, we just want to keep traveling. And not, most parents say, oh, wait till you have kids. You can't travel anymore. Like, it's impossible. And they were like, just kind of beating us down a little bit with negative energy that the travel is over for 20 years of our life. And so it's almost a challenge to figure out how to travel better. And so as we're leading up to it, right when we had Cash, we started spitballing with the idea back within the few months before we had him. But as soon as we had him, we just brainstormed this idea. And I remember my wife was nursing, and maybe too much information, but she was nursing at like 2 a.m. And I got up with her and with the laptop and said, I got this idea. You literally can't move because you're stuck with a baby on your body. And so I have you pinned down. I have this idea. Let's work through it together. And she was all game for it. And the idea was that we wanted to travel, but hotels weren't a fit anymore. Obviously, having a baby is really difficult. To have a baby in the room and for it to be romantic and fun and it's expensive, it's not that good. Airbnb didn't even exist back then. They were 08 founded. So this is 07. Mm-hmm. Is all she had was Vrbo, and Vrbo back then was highly unsophisticated and very inconsistent. They still are. They all are inconsistent in the offering, but they're way better now than they were back 17 years ago, 16 years ago. And then, so rentals, we liked the concept, but we didn't want the lack of consistency because you have a baby, you're like, you want clean, you want comfortable, mm-hmm. you want, and you just didn't know if you're going to get them. And then the third option was buying a home, and we didn't have any money. So obviously it would be great to buy a home, except when you have, a couple nickels to your name, it really wasn't going to be a financial possibility. So we thought, wouldn't it be amazing though, if you had a portfolio of your own second homes, we could have 30 homes all set up like our own second homes that we could travel to anytime. And that was the founding of Luxus. And so we thought, well, how do you actually do that? And you have to do it almost by a fractional. We actually did a private equity fund, but very similar to a fractional approach. And we raised, we went to friends and family. We put in 150 grand, which is all we had. My parents put in roughly the same. And we found 16 other friends and family before we had an office, a team, anything. They said, we want to go buy 3 vacation homes. We're going to buy them together. This is pre-Great Recession. So the prices were coming down, but they weren't certainly, they were a little bit off their peak, but not in the doldrums yet, which was a really good opportunity, by the way. It was a good run. And then we said, okay, we're going to buy 3 homes. We raised the money. The concept was roughly 5 people per home. And so you would know that every person would get a couple months of time per year to use. And instead of renting them out, effectively, we would just rent them from ourselves. So we rent them at cost, basically. And we bought a condo in Maui, a home in Scottsdale, Arizona, and a lake property in Okanagan, British Columbia, Western Canada. And that was the start. And we ended, bought them all with cash. And it was really meant to be purely lifestyle. And the idea was to hold it for 10 years and sell them for some form of appreciation in 2018. So we got it going, and we got these first few homes, and we hired our first employee, and it was kind of a really big deal. And then very quickly, those 18 people started telling friends. And the snowball effect, I think back of my whole career, of everything we've done, the snowball effect from basically 08 to 13 was just so wild how quickly the word spread and grew. And I'm just like still humbled by the amount of support people gave us. We ended up raising close to 100 million, about 50 homes over that time period. Wow. Within these kind of these pools. And it's just, I still wonder how we did it because there's no sales team. It was me. And I hired a couple of amazing team members that joined me from day one. One is still with me today. And we didn't sell anything. We just basically told the story. And as a result, people were just investing 150 grand at a time, 200 grand at a time. And we just kept taking that cash and buying more assets. And of course, during 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 is a really good buying opportunity. So fortunately, that had a good, nice uplift for those properties that we acquired during that time. That was just luck. That wasn't anything. But we started this business model, and the money was coming in from our economy in Alberta was good at the time. And of course, the global economy was struggling. And as a result, real estate prices were good. So we got some really nice properties at a very deep discount, which just improved the lifestyle aspect. And, there's multiple iterations of Luxus, but that was the first, that's how the whole thing got kicked off. It was just a problem my wife and I had for our own family. So we resolved it for ourselves, which then we quickly found out that we resolved it for many other people. And we since planned about 20,000 vacations for that group of investors over those properties. We have a concierge team, an asset management team. We have on on the ground concierge team on each of the destinations. So it kind of grew to become a, I'm gonna say sophisticated. Maybe we had at its peak 40 or 50 full-time equivalents, either in our office, head office, or directly on the grounds, so or employed full-time. But it was very big for us. And it was a fun run.
Fantastic. No, I love that. That's an incredible story. And so backing up a little bit. So the original premise really was it, and I know that you weren't selling anything. You were just kind of telling the story of just really, you know, solving your own problem and ultimately just, you know, talking about that and other people showed interest, you know, initially friends and family, and then, you know, their friends and their family, this, that, and the other, and that snowball effect was created. And you'd mentioned that you were just essentially renting it back from yourselves at cost. And so was the original allure just to simply for folks to have, you know, an amazing property that maybe they wouldn't have been able to afford, you know, independently on their own, that, you know, they got a fractional piece and they can get a couple months out of the year without having to, you know, lug over the entire $1 million for that property, instead $150,000, maybe get a month or two out of the year to use it. Was that the original premise, or was there an element of ROI built in there as well outside of the appreciation? I know that you'd said maybe in 10 years we'd sell for the appreciation portion. Was there any other ROI element factored into the original business model?
Yeah, so great point. So yes, the original, there's kind of three components to it. So lifestyle was the basis. Like, you're doing this, you're not buying this purely as an investment. This is really a lifestyle investment. You're doing it because you want to travel up, travel better, and not have someone else dealing with the hassles. So that was the idea. You get 6 weeks a year through $31 million homes, $2 million homes, versus having one property or a fraction of one property. So that was lure number one. Number two is capital preservation appreciation. So we're buying in this dip. We're obviously going into another dip now. So we're going to be kind of targeting a different type of model, but very similar concept, by as much as we can during this upcoming cycle. The third one, because people are renting at cost, the ROI actually wasn't in the form of a dividend where they get a check back because there was a certain level of profitability. Because we kind of goal-seeked everything back to cost, the ROI came from, which was a very big allure for a lot of people, was what's the cost for me to replicate a comparable vacation? And it was generally around 3 to 4 times the actual cost of ownership. So let's just say the cost of owning a property worked out to $250 a night. The average cost to rent that property was $1,000 a night.
Got it.
So that for them, they're like, well, my current travel budget is $30,000, and I'm only going to be spending $10,000 this program. So I have $20,000 cash in my pocket that I otherwise would have been spending, which basically I put that $20,000 on my $200,000 investment. I'm making 10% a year. So that was really the true ROI component. And so I made a really, really unique approach to it. And now, not that people did it specifically for that, that was just the natural consequence of the model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, very interesting. So obviously there's been a very significant evolution in the short-term rental space back from, again, you know, VRBO was around, but I remember back then, I mean, it was just a very disorganized website with very little consistency to it. And you know, way better today than what it was back then. But again, it was in its infancy stages. It still has a long way to go, but either way. So let's talk about just you talk about like the evolution of the short-term rental space, and then I've never looked at the data of what it looked like leading up to COVID. And then, you know, that 2.5 year span during COVID, like the accelerator factor that kicked in with everybody and their brother looking to get into short-term rental space. So just maybe explain a little bit of the evolutionary process that you've seen through your perspective over the years, and then ultimately maybe what that opportunity looks like here moving on in the future.
Absolutely. So because of just the natural way the model worked, we obviously bought homes that were short-term rental friendly. We looked at them against the market conditions. What would it cost to replicate that vacation? So even though for the first 8 years we weren't actually renting them out, we became very well informed about the space, the things that worked and the things that didn't work. And of course, Airbnb was on its ride up. Mm-hmm. And the biggest thing, as you well know, in the short-term rental space is just the regulation. You know, New York was one of the first cities from 08 to 10 where they started to put in regulations because effectively like residential apartment buildings were turning into glorified hotels. Mm-hmm. Everyone was just buying whole floors and then renting them out. And New York was the first, rightfully so, to crack down on it, even though they blamed it on like health and safety. It's really with the hotel lobby pushing back. And out of fairness to the hotels, they pay a higher tax rate. They have higher standards for safety. And if a residential building turned into a hotel, it's not fair. So Now, we actually got kicked out of two buildings as a result because we bought before these regulations took place. We had to move to short-term rental friendly buildings. So we're very, very familiar with that process. The thing that was missing always in that thing was, so once regulations started to set, and still, as you will know, different cities are still in the middle of their regulatory process. There's some cities that still don't have a framework because they are so afraid of class action lawsuits, which has happened in multiple cities when they shut down short-term rentals. So it's still risky business, aside from the cities that have established a framework for short-term regulations, how it works. But the reason why it was never really like an institutionalized asset class, if you think of all the real estate asset classes, multifamily, student housing, hospitality, institutions invest into them. They never did because they never knew what level of risk was associated with. You could have 100 rentals and called, you know, Toronto, and then Toronto regulates it, and then you now have zero rentals because they're all regulated. So how that arc has happened now, regulations come in, and then you had this in addition to regulation, this massive run of demand from clients because of COVID. So you had that hockey stick approach where people wanted, hotels were done for the period of a year and everyone to this. And then you had everyone getting into business and people were making good money off short-term rentals and still do, which is phenomenal. So it's something that we've always loved. The question is how does it look going forward? And you've probably seen there's so many different niches along the way, the short-term space. There's smaller brands, bigger brands, companies like Sonder, which are, you know, kind of like, you know, forming like unicorn status, that are trying to create like a consistent approach to their experiences. And then you have the platforms like Vrbo and Airbnb, which is all about volume. Consistency is a secondary. They can't control the hosts and how their experience resides. And but they can control their listing volume. So they're just going purely about listing volume. And I think there is, and so personally, we're launching something new that's going to be in that particular space. So taking everything we learned from the first 16 years about management of vacation properties, but applying them into a cash flow scenario. Because finally, I believe there's enough sophistication in the distribution platforms where you can actually get predictable returns. And if you're a one-off person in one market, it's kind of hard. But I think when you hit some scale, you can start to see that it's going to become a 6 cap or an 8 cap or a 10 cap or whatever that market might generate, because you finally have the data that's coming from these and it's public, like AirDNA and different ways are consolidating that data. And I think there's actually a lot of money to be made in the space as now that you start to see institutional style money enter it. And I think that's going to snowball in a like significant way the next 5 years, where these guys have these $100 billion real estate portfolios and they want to carve off 5% for the STR space. There's literally not a dollar in the space currently. That's under exaggeration. There's low billions, but not the hundreds of billions like there is in everything else. So anyway, long-winded thing about the STR space. I think it's great. I think there's lots of ways to make money in the food chain around it, whether you're servicing it, you're running them yourselves, you're creating scale. But I think that finally the next 5 years, because of this COVID, it's been accepted now as a place where capital can flow into. I think there's going to be a lot of money going to space. And a lot of people are going to get wealthy doing it.
How do you avoid the risk of saturation? Again, I feel like there's probably a number of markets, and I don't have the data. I'm just going from just the outside looking in, right, through a kind of a foggy lens over the last couple of years. But it would seem just from, you know, just the pure interest level rising so quickly, especially during COVID, with staycations, and again, you know, folks looking to allocate capital into these different short term rentals or converting a single family into a short term rental. How does one avoid, when you guys are looking for new opportunities, how does one avoid a market that ultimately it could be nearing the risk of saturation or will be there or might be there, already is there? Is there enough data out there to, you know, for you guys to make an educated decision around either we're going to this market or we're staying away from it?
Yeah, it's a really, really good point. I think there's two approaches that we would take specifically on saturation effect. And because everyone has, I'd say everyone generalizing us has converted their property to an STR, it has created saturation. And now there's complaints, you know, people aren't getting the returns because people are going back to hotels now. And, you know, the world's a little bit recessionary or kind of wherever it is in the economic cycle. But there was just too many properties came online. So there's two aspects. One is a place that is unregulated that is going to be regulated. So naturally, cities that have added regulation is basically cleaning up the saturation effect just for themselves. So maybe an example, San Diego, they just, you know, I believe it's officially passed now. They're changing that maximum 1% of total residential dwelling units can have STR permits. So there's going to be some grandfather clauses, and there's probably legal foot battles going on right now. We'll see where it lands. But effectively, they've just naturally unsaturated that market because there a whole bunch of people are going to be kicked out of their STRs or will not be able to renew their STR permits. And that's like market by market. There's so much of that going on. So we look for markets that are potentially unregulated, going through regulation, that is going to naturally clean up their, you know, for every 100 Airbnb listings, maybe there's actually 10 that are going to be legal for the long run. Vegas right now is going through a massive enforcement because there's 20,000 illegal Airbnbs in Las Vegas, but the hotel lobby is like, you got to shut that down. So they put an enforcement officer. So I would look at Vegas, but I would only pick areas that are 100% certain that they're actually allowed and not an illegal version. Mm-hmm. So our approach on that is really understand the regulation, or you go to a place that's already passed the regulation and there's less Airbnbs. So you just have to find the pockets where you can buy. And you're going to probably have to overpay for them a little bit more because they kind of own a corner of the market. Yeah. I think of Palm Springs area, Rancho Mirage, Palm Desert, those are really good examples of significant lack of Airbnbs because of the moratoriums they put in STRs. So anyone looking at regulation is a really, really good approach to know if is it going to be truly saturated forever or is it a temporary thing until regulation passes. The second component we look at is niches. So kind of like, you know, the riches are in the niches, but if you can find a niche property or community within a saturated market that has a higher demand for that particular community because they have maybe certain amenities that, you know, instead of just a single family home on a random residential street, maybe there's like pools and, you know, there's golf simulators and there's other golf courses, other access they can have. So if we go to a market that says, okay, let's say Arizona was a good example. Arizona was state regulated, not city regulated. They've now passed some regulation to the city level to add some enforcement, I guess, around it. But Arizona got saturated because everyone around the state was on the same rules. So in that particular case, we try to find a niche community that's really, really special. And because then when people are looking, they're like, I want to be in that community and there's only 20 Airbnbs in that community and I have to pay extra just to be in that community. And then you get the repeat business model where people say, I got to rebook this for next year. If you're just part of one of 1,000 homes on a street that all kind of look the same, it's just going to be harder to compete. You know, you can do a good job of managing, but it's you have the saturation effect. So anyway, long-winded answer, but those are two approaches we look at the areas.
I appreciate that. On the flip side of that question would be, you know, given that we are, you know, one can argue that we're entering into a recessionary environment, you know, maybe folks aren't traveling as much as what they were, you know, maybe there's certain markets that were oversaturated with Airbnbs or folks bought into that short-term rental model. And just maybe forecasted a little incorrectly with their pro forma, a litany of reasons, right? But do you feel like there's going to be some opportunity flushed out, you know, good properties that maybe discounted rates given, you know, some of the oversaturation that's occurred over the last couple of years?
Yes, great, great point. It's actually part of the reason why we're getting ready to launch something new here. We see that a lot of people have overbought. It's unfortunate, just the reality of an economic cycle, obviously, but that people haven't making the cash requirement to service their mortgage. And obviously some people, mortgages were never, you know, subprime days, but they're, you know, 10, 20, 25%. And if someone's lost amount of value, they're close to being underwater, but they have bookings, they already have, you know, a bit of a revenue stream coming in, but not enough to service their debt and their operating costs. I think there's going to be a lot of people looking just to exit. And so there's going to be a great buying opportunity where I feel like you can go acquire, let's say Joe's rental in Scottsdale, and he already has 50 grand of bookings on the books for you. And he's willing to sell at a 20% discount because he overpaid. And that just gets him, he loses his equity, but he's not going to be defaulting on the mortgage. And you're actually in a place to get something where you can start cash flowing it at a new kind of cost basis. And they already have rentals. And part of the issue with Airbnbs is the onboarding time it takes to get initial rentals on the books. It takes a year to kind of get to some form of stabilized income. And so I think a lot of people are going to be looking that maybe stretch themselves a bit. And that's, I've stretched myself. I think all entrepreneurs have. So I don't discount that as a tough thing for someone, but that's part of someone's learning, and it's going to be someone else's opportunity to come in and enter a unit that's maybe already set up great, has some repeat clients. It just isn't quite hitting the threshold, and you kind of add your effort, your twist, your client list, where you can ultimately juice it up to a rate of return that makes sense on that unit.
I think those who get impacted the most are, you know, still the W-2 earners that were just looking to buy one, two, or three of these short-term rentals themselves to offset for retirement purposes. Again, just kind of got caught up in the frenzy, created some, inaccurate pro formas just based on, you know, what was at present time, call it 2020, 2021, and ultimately have found themselves in a different environment here today and are finding that they have to supplement, you know, that note payment each month with their W-2 income, which was never really the plan. And I know, and again, I haven't really dug too much into the short-term rental space, but it, you know, just again, from the outside looking in, it seemed like it got to a point as well where there were some more aggressive loan products out there as well that were, that were working within the industry that allowed folks to kind of leverage on pro formas and, revenue that wasn't yet there, and which can pose some riskiness as well, especially for someone that doesn't have a track record. Have you seen the same thing?
Totally, for sure. But I feel bad. I mean, again, I can't control the global economic cycle and what goes on, but I still feel bad. There's a lot of friends, you know, they're buying 2021, 2022, like the absolute peak market of human history. And you just know that. You didn't know when it was going to stop going up. You just knew eventually it'd be a reset. And some markets are a little more insulated than others, and they're not going to have the same dip. And some are going to have more of a crash effect. I don't think it'll be as bad as like the 08. But if you have 15%, equity in, I mean, a lot of people, that's going to be wiped out. And it's it's a bummer. Yeah. But it does create opportunity. A lot of the people have put in tremendous hustle and got their friends and family booking and set the home up really good. And that's a lot of cost that is sunk when you acquire an asset. So if someone's flush with cash right now looking over the next 12 months, I would look for those deals. Contact your realtors in your areas that know the STR space really, really well. Follow the guys. And then when someone's not making their note payments and they need to get out, you want to kind of be ready to jump in. And now your basis is at 80 cents on the dollar. So maybe that 60,000 income actually can make the note payments, your new note payment. Maybe you can renegotiate a better deal, or maybe you can pay off the note or whatever. But I think a lot of people stretch themselves. It's a natural part of a cycle. And as a result, there's going to be people with cash on the sidelines that are going to do very well the next couple of years.
So you'd mentioned that you guys are kind of, you're preparing, for, some of these potential opportunities. Is that a new project? Is that something that you guys are going to be rolling out here soon? Or just, I guess, better way to ask the question, what are some new and exciting projects that you guys have in the works at present time there? Because I know you've got your hands in a number of different pots underneath the Luxus umbrella. Get us up to speed with some new exciting things you're working on.
Sure. I'll talk about our development arm first, just a short one. I'll jump into the cash flow and kind of annuity thing, right? And hopefully it might help some of the listeners think about where they could, make some opportunity the next couple of years. But in between 2014 and 2021 today, we started a development side. And the idea of it at the time was kind of just an entrepreneurial mindset of, we see this, we met all these amazing people around the world by buying these first 50 properties. And some of them had land and some had hotels and some had different things that didn't fit our buckets, like our buying box. But we thought, wouldn't it be cool to like do this or that? And so we eventually just decided to do something. And in 2014, we launched three projects. We are the managing partner, put in money. Two we did with partner capital, like a number of partners, and one we did on our own. And there was a project in Hawaii at the Big Island, a project in Tuscany, and a project in Rancho Mirage or Palm Springs, California. And all three had their struggles. I'll be honest, like it was the toughest one by far was Big Island. It was just something that we struggled with from, I want to say, day one. We had a really great first year and a half, and then we had financing challenges. Capital stack wasn't dialed in the way that it should have been. The volcano erupted. I mean, I take responsibility for the issue with the capital stack and some of the financing challenges and not really realizing how really challenging it could be in this market. But we finally got our ducks in a row and everything organized, and the volcano erupted. And that was like the nail in the coffin for us. It was so frustrating. But what we learned about that is that you got to be prepared for any blind spot. And then, of course, a global pandemic. Like, who would think volcano and global pandemic? There's blind spots that can happen. They can cut you off of the knees. And it was very, very difficult. And I'm very proud and very grateful and humbled by my investors that, invest along. We got through it. We got the project done. It's won awards. It's phenomenal. The homeowners are great there. But it financially was not a success. And so that was my greatest learning over that time period about the development side. And then we basically thought, are we going to continue to do developments and just kind of walk away from, you know, the failures and just, or do something else? Like, I think the best way to honor failure is to learn from it and re-ante. And so we thought, well, let's give it another run, and we're going to have to be a lot smarter how we're going to handle things. And it worked out where we ended up getting into a couple new projects. Our Tuscany side of the business was the first kind of domino that fell in about midway through COVID, like early 2021, where we had one project there and it was struggling. Italy was the second epicenter of COVID. And so it wasn't, we felt like there was a lot of fortunes against us in 2020. And then we sold it and it set a record for Siena province. And all of a sudden, we got interest from some other families, and we now have kind of a 2-year backlog of work there, taking these old farmhouses that are ruins, ancient ruins, and restoring them to become luxury private estates for families. And it's been just a remarkable journey and super fun. And it's really special because you're restoring a piece of history every time you do it. And that was the first bit of glimmer of success that we kind of saw coming out of COVID. And then the latest one, which is something I'm really proud of and very, very, very excited about. It's too long a story for this podcast, but it's we end up in Las Vegas through a series of connections and good fortune and timing and hard work. We're able to make a partnership to create two luxury towers in Henderson, Nevada. And we just recently partnered and signed on with Four Seasons to become a Four Seasons private residential community. So really, really exciting for us. We are building a hotel with Marriott in Playa del Carmen, Mexico. So that was our first foray into working with a brand, a global hospitality brand. And Four Seasons is just another level. They're both highly sophisticated and very, very good to work with, but an absolutely tremendous honor. And Four Seasons has been phenomenal to work with, and it's going to be a really exciting project. So my managing partner, John, he runs that side. So I'm not involved in day-to-day on that. And he's really the brains and the kudos to for the efforts that they've fought through the last 2 years to get that deal done. It'll be another 3 years to build, but if you see Four Seasons Las Vegas, it's not the hotel, it's the residential side, and it's going to be really, really cool. So we're very proud of that. A lot of water going to the bridge, there's a lot of things we have to get done in these projects, but have achieved a couple significant milestones that are putting us on, you know, the right path. So now
it sounds like we might need to have another show to maybe dive a little deeper into some of these other items. Seriously.
Yeah. I'd be happy to talk about the arc of a development thing, but to shift on the cash flow thing for people that I think, and particularly listeners in your space, development thing is a lot of money to be made and lost because the levered risk of those projects. But one thing we're missing and really wanted to get into is a significant annuity business, something that can, you know, pay you forever, basically. And obviously rentals, you know, has been going on forever. Multifamily and anything you can create an annual income stream can be a very powerful thing. And it takes a long time to get your first few going, but then it does become a snowball effect. If you've done it well, don't get underwater, you re-leverage and continue to pour that money to build a portfolio. The easiest way over time is to do it by a multifamily, because you could buy one building with 10 units that are all cash flowing. STR, as we discussed earlier, has been very hard because of inconsistency around revenue streams and lack of predictability, but there is enough data around that now. So we are, as a company, we're taking a shift, but we're launching a new product that's going to focus on the short-term rental space. And so for all the reasons we already discussed, the regulation, the buying opportunity because of the recessionary environment we're going into, the sophistication of the distribution platforms like Airbnb and VRBO, we are going to be launching what we're going to try to create effectively is like an institutional quality portfolio of properties that is generating a consistent return that would be of interest to a family office or an institution or private equity fund or whatever in the future. And so that is such a different approach, because you need to buy properties to fit the brand that we're creating, which is really going to kind of be $1 million to $3 million. That's about our average price point of homes. And we're using outside capital to be, we'll be partnering with anchor investors and people that are acquiring the assets, and our role is to manage them and create a consistent return. So it's really neat, because you got to take like a very sophisticated like underwriting approach to say like, what will each market get in terms of a cap rate? Mm-hmm. And funny, it's very linear compared to different markets. You go to New York, it's like under 2%, but that's what also multifamily and stuff gets in New York, because you buy it in New York for like just long-term cap appreciation. And then you go to Mexico and you can get like 15% because it's the risk of it also of the capital is more up and down and everything in between. So it's been, we've been working on it for a year now. It'll be, you know, probably looking like a fall launch of 2023. And we want to be really ready to kind of capture whatever the dip, bottom of the dip is. And that's obviously a crystal ball. So we don't know for certain how deep and how long, but we're trying to get all of our ducks in order to be prepared for the summer and leading into the fall. And we're trying to pick properties that aren't, it's not all about picking the winners. It's a blended approach to a portfolio to say, can we get a consistent cap rate, you know, between 6 to 10% that would compete head to head with any of the other asset classes. And so for listeners, I would say I'm not the only one that we're trying to do. There's other groups out there. They're going to be looking for people that have assembled their own mini portfolios of, you know, let's say 10 properties in Miami that are all cash flowing. You might get, and I'm just guessing, but you might get a better return selling to a group like we're talking about that want to have a cash flowing product, and they'll pay you based on cash flow and cap rate versus just property values, which if you're doing well, you actually get more than your property value. So I think there's a good roll-up strategy with people that have multiple assets that I think in 3, 4, 5 years from now, we'll be cashing out with really nice check sizes because, but they got to get them cash flowing. They got to be in a safe STR environment and they got to be cash flowing.
I think that's one of the beautiful things that's ultimately come out of the evolution of the single family rental space. And you can kind of lump short-term rentals into that as well as, you know, 10 years ago. And I've owned very large portfolios many years back of single family rentals, but you know, back then, you know, there weren't really many large portfolio buyers. I mean, it was not institutionalized at all. And, and really the valuation was based on the, you know, comparative sales approach. Like there was no income approach. You could run your analysis however you wanted and apply a cap rate to it, but like, it didn't matter. Like that's not how it was going to be sold. And so I think that's definitely one of the benefits of institutions coming into the space and just really placing a larger light onto this industry and creating an industry out of it. I think it's a beautiful thing. So again, that didn't literally just 10 years ago, that really didn't exist. Now it does.
Well, Kevin, so I got to just jump in. This is, you're so, so accurate with that. I just have to validate this because you think of the, you know, the private single family home space pre-Great Recession, like you said, it was only based on homes worth 600 grand, it's worth 600 grand because a comparative market approach. It was never based on income. Great Recession came and companies like, you know, BlackRock and others were investing like billions of dollars in and bought tens of thousands of homes. And they effectively institutionalized single family home units. And now they're selling these whole portfolios based on, you know, the income approach versus just the comparable market approach. So I'm totally with you. I just have to like validate that because I want to say it now here. The same thing's going to happen in the STR space in the next 5 years. And I do believe that groups like that, well, not believe, it's already happening. So it's just a matter of the pace that it happens will be as soon as people can get predictable, stable cash flow on these properties, people are going to start buying clusters of these because these guys don't want to do one at a time. It takes too long. But I don't mind it. Maybe you don't. And some of that, and probably many of your listeners don't mind one at a time. And you can build 15, 10, or 20, 30 homes. All of a sudden now it's like you have a 30 door multifamily complex you're selling to a REIT because in 5 years, REITs are going to have slivers of their portfolio dedicated to this. They just need to make 5% a year. That's all they care about. Yep. And so, and anyway, I have to say it because I think there's a huge opportunity in the next 5 years.
Well, I think that's it. You know, in any evolving industry, you know, if you can become the aggregator, you know, when it's just becoming institutionalized, I mean, that's where the big money is made. I mean, we're in the manufactured housing space, and 10 years ago, we've been buying mobile home parks for 12 years, and you know, institutions really didn't start taking a look at this industry for about until about 6 years ago, give or take, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, and in the last like 4 or 5 years. There's been a massive influx of tens of billions, hundreds of billions of dollars, just really trying to aggregate and consolidate this industry. And so, you know, ultimately what was a great cash flowing portfolio 8, 9, 10 years ago, you had to piecemeal it to sell it off. You know, it just, there wasn't an element on the other side and you weren't getting a premium for a portfolio. Whereas nowadays that's exactly what these portfolios or these institutions are looking for. They don't want to go assemble, you know, one mobile home park by one mobile home park to, you know, end up with $100 billion worth. It's going to take them too much time, too much energy and effort. They just want to go write a $100 billion check and take it all off your hands at a premium price.
At a premium price. It's so. And one more thing, I think for the listeners that I think is huge value. If you can create a brand around your particular offering and have a legitimate client base, not relying exclusively on Airbnb, to be like your feeder system or any of the distribution platforms. If you can create, let's say you can buy 10 homes in a market, let's say it's in, I don't know, Scottsdale, Arizona, and you have 10 homes that all have consistent cash flow returns, consistent setup and stature, and you have your own database of people that are booking. You're not relying solely on the third-party distribution platforms. And you, let's say your brand is, you know, Steve's North Scottsdale Homes things, and you have this thing. People are going to want to acquire that because you have client list that's already booking your properties, and you also have, you check all the boxes for the app, like good quality asset, STR friendly, cash flowing. But a lot of people are just buying homes and exclusively using the third-party platforms. I think a lot of people don't know how to start necessarily a brand or to start to generate direct revenue. It's all friends and family to start. You just have, everyone has to realize no one has a way to magically create income from strangers. You start with friends and family, you start the organic approach, then you can get in digital marketing, you have a bit of money, and you can start to grow that way. But if you build a bit of a brand and a small portfolio, to your exact point, mobile home parks is a great example. Storage, I mean, storage guys, I had a couple of clients that sold their storage for like multiple times revenue. It used to do like 3 times EBITDA. Now it's like 6 times revenue. It's like, how are people even selling things? And they said, you know, we had one client, they said someone bought their business. They said $100 million more than they thought it was worth. Like, how do you get a gap on a business of the $100 million? It wasn't even worth $100 million to begin with. So it's because these guys are paying, these big institutions just want steady, stable cash flow. They like brands because there's some safety that comes along with, even if they merge your brand into their brand, they still like the knowing that you have some consistent following.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's gonna be fun to watch the next 5 years.
Yeah,
I'm excited.
No, I agree. No, some humor here. So when we started buying mobile home parks, and it was probably at the tail end, you know, so about 12 years ago, we bought our first mobile home, but the antiquated nature of that industry and the lack of institutional players in our space, most mobile home parks, or most at least legacy owners of mobile home parks, guys that have developed these things, they've been in it for 30, 40, 50 years. They were, the model that they were used to on the disposition side was a price per space. It literally had no relevance to the cash flow at all. I mean, it's absolutely amazing to think back about that. I remember talking to folks that were selling assets and they're like, well, I'm looking for $23,000 to $25,000 a space. I'm like, well, what is that based on? can you tell me what's the gross revenues? I mean, like, give me some financials here so I can at least, you know, come up with some type of ROI on this thing and what it's doing. But to them, it was just a price per space, and it was probably based upon what they originally developed it for. Well, we originally spent $8,000 developing each one of these spaces, and we feel like, you know, tripling our money over the last 25 years, that's good. And that's what we're looking for.
Okay. That's so wild, huh? Is it like crazy to think? It's nuts.
Anyway. Well, Steve, this has been a lot of fun, man. I really appreciate you coming on here. I feel like there's a number of other questions I've got in my mind. I want to be respectful of your time and the listeners' time here, but we definitely have to do another show. Cause one other thing I want to ask you, and I'm just going to put this right here, drop it as a seed. I would love to talk a little bit more about the ancient ruins that you guys are basically restoring and renovating and turning them into, you know, unique short-term rental properties. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the elements of a lot of folks that just get started in real estate investing, a lot of people feel that you have to kind of invest in your backyard. Like there's a comfort level there. Like you can see it, you can touch it, you can feel it. And a lot of folks have this massive hurdle of investing outside of their local market. Well, taking it to another country and then throwing in the element of like historical buildings and things of that nature, I mean, that is like, you know, multiple levels above that as far as just challenges associated with it. So I would love to maybe talk about that at some point. I'm just dropping it as a seed right now. So maybe we can have a future conversation about it. Would love to get a better understanding of that business model. How do you get boots on the ground there? How do you guys build a team and an infrastructure around that and pull projects like that off successfully being so far away? So anyway,
that chat. I'll say one thing that will be a good segue into that conversation. I'd love to have that conversation because we've operated in multiple countries and they all have their own unique challenges. But there's one singular thing, which is the constant. It's this proximity to people in the market. So how do you create proximity to the space that you want to be in? I think if you leave it on that for today, for me, it's been conversations like this. It's been masterminds. It's been business groups. It's been investing in certain areas, but always playing the long game. But it's all about building relationships. If you want to do something in Belize, you just can't show up to Belize and do something. You have to have a long-standing relationship with someone in Belize, been doing business there for a long time before you would do that. Mm-hmm. And I think most people want to make the money quick, But you just you can't. If these are such long game approaches, but if you take the long game, you think over a 20-year time span, if I can enter multiple different markets, but it's going to take 7 years before I make my true first dollar, most people just don't want to put that time in.
Yeah.
But if you do, that's how we did in Italy. It's how we done it in Mexico. It's how we spent 7 years really not making much, building relationships, building a couple of key relationships. And then as a result, you can all of a sudden, the right opportunity comes in, the first domino falls. So I can leave it at that for today, but I can happily share how you build the infrastructure and how we've approached it, where our fails have been and our opportunities have been. But absent of a relationship, it's very, very difficult to enter new markets. So build relationships. You know, there you
awesome.
Go.
I love it. I love it. Well, Steve, for those that want to learn more about you and your group and the different things you guys have working, where's the best place to find you?
You bet. You can go to luxusgroup.com. So LUXUS group.com. Check that out. My Instagram is Stephen Potaski. I don't honestly regularly post so I won't find anything super inspiring there. Maybe a little family travels, but we do have a YouTube channel. It's kind of been an on and off endeavor for me personally, where we give some education around short-term rentals, buying, about our fishing lodge we have in Northern Canada, a few different things. So you can go to just search the Luxus Group on YouTube, and you'll be able to find stuff there. So that's one that if anyone wants to learn, I have 20 videos on there from the past, and they're just stuff that gives you basically free information. So feel free to take advantage of it.
Awesome. Steven, it's been a pleasure having you, my friend. I appreciate you joining us here today.
Thanks, Kevin. Thanks for putting this out to the world and sharing all these great stories with awesome entrepreneurs. I appreciate it.
Alrighty, guys, that's all we have for this week's show. So until we meet again next week, this is your host, Kevin Bupp, wishing you huge success. Take care.
Congratulations. Now you've got more of the best tricks of the trade in building massive amounts of passive income from real estate. For more amazing resources, visit realestateinvestingforcashflow.com. And we'll see you next Monday morning.